Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Rabat, Morocco. Welcome back to Deliver. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryant, and I have been enjoying learning a lot lately. I've been reading a lot, reading for recreational purposes, educational purposes, looking at a lot of videos on YouTube and brilliant CuriosityStream, all these different platforms that teach you things. It's amazing how much I want to learn now versus when I was younger and I didn't want to learn. So it's interesting. So I've been learning a lot. And one of the things I really like learning about is when people want to talk on the show about a topic that's really important to them or really that they're passionate about. And today I have such a guest. So my guest today is the head of product at the product management software company, Rodeo. He writes many blog posts for Serious Scrum about product management and Scrum together. And he frequently speaks at events and on podcasts, including now on this very one. Please welcome Martin Dahmer. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Happy to be here, man.
Martin has reached out because I've referenced two of his articles, at least two of his articles that he wrote on Serious Scrum that I recommended him. And he kind of said, hey, let's talk about one of those or let's talk about a topic that's interesting. I said, yes, because that's what I want to do. I want to talk to folks and get their opinions that's different from mine. And so Martin and I are going to talk about some of the things that he's written about in the past and some of the things that he sees, as well as I do, that people get stuck in.
Yes, exactly.
Very good. The first couple articles that I read, the first one is from Kristen Behrman, who has an article titled Four Ways a Behavioral Scientist Can Help Product Managers. Really interesting. I love behavioral science, behavioral economics, one of those little side things that I have to read or learn about those things. Really good article. Two of the things that she talks about is behavioral scientists can help reveal underlying psychology driving a person's behavior, something that, yes, we can build a product and yes, we can release a product. What are we looking to change? Ideally, we're looking to change some people's behaviors or massive amounts of people's behaviors to do a certain thing, do a certain thing better. And understanding the psychology of why they want to do that or how we can help them do that is where one example of a behavioral scientist can come into play. So I like that notion. It's something that I try to do more of. It's something I see a lot of people don't get time to do, but it's something that I think could really help product people. Have you ever worked with somebody who had a behavioral scientist background or anything like that, Martin?
No, I haven't. But I can say I've read a lot of books on this topic. So I find it super fascinating. Like just the way how you frame something can have a huge impact. So I've actually tried to do these things. Back when I was trying those things, it was like 10 years ago or 8 years ago. I didn't measure the result, but I was already thinking about these kind of things.
That's cool. And one other thing that she has in here, a second one that I really like, is behavioral scientists can help you isolate a key assumption that you're making or your team is making and design a test around that, a rapid test, to get feedback to see, is that assumption correct? Is that assumption incorrect? That kind of cuts to those core things that we talk about doing a lot, which is I like finding that core loop that your product is trying to do or that core problem that you're trying to solve. And this is one step further, which is what are the assumptions that you're making about that loop or that core problem, and how can you build a test? And this is where people get into, is this a test? Is it an experiment? Is it an MVP? Is it something else? But design something that's really small to give you feedback on it. Behavioral scientists really can be something, another voice in your team to help you get to that. And I like that concept.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I think it's difficult to do, like to do right. But obviously I'm not an expert.
Well, and I don't claim to be an expert. I claim, like I said, I like learning about things. So this is one of the things I really like to learn about. And that's one of the things that she suggests also is get some behavioral science training. If you don't have a behavioral scientist on your team, in your company, you, as the product person, go learn some about this so you can start to incorporate some of these thoughts. And I think that's great. She has a few links in the article, which we'll put in the show note if you want to do that. And that's something that I'm looking at. What could I do to get more behavioral science training? So I think that's a really good concept from Kristen. And the next one is from Bill Skeet, who says, if you love design, it's time to stop liking it. Interesting concept. And this one, I think this came out last year in 2020, and it took me a while to get to it or somebody reposted it, which is how it came up on my radar again. But one of the interesting things here is about critique. And I think critique is a very good thing to look at, because as product people, we are constantly either critiquing or being critiqued about something. And those critiques can devolve into bad things, judgment valuations, and things like that. What he's specifically talking about here is the phrase, I like it, or good job. Things that are very generic sounding, or things that are subjective, things that are not specific. And if you like design, or if you like a design, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before on the show because it's a problem I constantly have with my family, with friends or anything else, is you talk about, okay, we're going to remodel a kitchen or we're going to redesign this screen. Okay, you put a design out or a design is presented. You may like the design. You may not like the design. Tell me what you don't like or do like about it specifically. Do you like the color? Do you like the style? Do you like this element? Do you not like this element? Be specific. Don't just say, I like it.
I think it makes a lot of sense, to be honest. But I also think when you give someone else feedback, right? If somebody just says, good job, you're like, yeah, great. What did I do?
What did I do? Exactly. Yes. And that's what the core of the message is whatever you say that you like about it, be specific. I like this aspect of it. I don't like this aspect of it. And it's not a value judgment. It's not to set up. And this is the other thing that I appreciate about the article is that sets up a like it versus don't like it argument. Half the room could like it. Half the room could not like it. But that's all they say. I like it. I don't like it. What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? Because maybe there's some common ground there that we can build on. Or maybe there's some, you know, irreplaceable or, you know, unmovable thing that both sides are just not going to move on. But it helps to know that versus like it or don't like it. And like I said, this is really about critiquing things, learning how to critique. There was a book that I read a while ago about design critique. And it's something that I want to dig a little bit deeper in and do a future show on, is about critique and how to do that well. Because I think it's something that's critical, because a customer may say, I don't like this. And that's frequently we hear from customers, I don't like this, or a salesperson say, I don't like that. Tell me what you don't like about it. Tell me what that's stopping you to dig a little deeper. Don't just deal with or accept an answer of, I like it, or good job.
It's a good one. I'll think about it. Like, because I think generally if you receive positive critique, then it'll be like, yeah, great, I'm happy. They're happy. But if you dig deeper, there's something to learn.
Yeah, that's one of the notions I've been reading a lot. Part of my reading I've been doing is reading a lot of different materials, but some of them are philosophy. And one of the things that I would like to do when somebody says, I like it, is, oh, tell me what you like about it. What did you like about it? Or when somebody says something like that, just I want to dig a little bit deeper. I want to find out a little bit more. I don't want to be, what's the word? I don't want to be praised without understanding what it was that happened. Or I don't want to give praise without understanding why I'm giving that praise. If praise is important. But that's, I dig a little deeper. That's all I think this is trying to say. And what's something I'm trying to reiterate poorly.
I think you're doing great.
Okay. So I hope you check out those articles from Kristen and Bill, and I hope you learn something from them as well.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
So Martin is here because he's written a few articles, and it's something that I see a lot of times happening with either new teams or teams that have been doing Scrum by the book for a while, is they get stuck in, Martin, you had a couple articles that talked about a Scrum prison, and we frequently hear this talked about with Melissa Perry's book is the Build Trap, or John Cutler's talking about feature factories. But one of the things that I was really grabbing from your article is this notion of don't get trapped in your sprint bubble. And how can you actually get out of that sprint bubble concept? It's something I totally agree with, which is get out of your bubble. Don't be stuck in your bubble. Don't just look at things that are inside your bubble. But it's amazing how many teams actually do get stuck there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, what I can say is I was working at a company and there were like 10 teams, and I saw all the product owners always busy in meeting rooms doing refinements or doing hours of sprint planning. And when there's a support ticket, they would start running towards their teams. And I just started wondering, what the hell are these people doing? Like, they're very busy, right? But what are they doing?
Yeah.
And yeah, by talking to them, I realized they're just busy in this sprint bubble. Like every sprint, there needs to be something delivered. And then when that's done, we're going to deliver the next thing. And yeah, then basically you don't have time for any of the other valuable things which you need to do as a product owner or a product manager.
One of the things that I've mentioned before on the show, and I try to get people to do as a first kind of recognition of what they're doing, is ask them where you're spending your time. Look at where you're spending your time. Are you spending it with your team, on the current sprint, on the next sprint? Where are you spending time with business, stakeholders, customers, whatever, thinking time? What, you know, are you sketching things out? Are you mapping things out? How much time are you spending per sprint or per day or per week or whatever, per iteration? And see, where are you spending the majority of your time? At least right now, not ideal, but just current, where are you spending the majority of time? And it's amazing how many people, A, don't want to do that.
No, you're right.
Because they're afraid of the answer. Or they think that, they try to tweak it. It's like, well, I should be spending, no, not should, how much are you doing? And just chart it out. It's not for anybody but for you. And it's to get you to notice things. Like I'm spending a lot of time in team meetings, or I'm spending a lot of time in sprint planning, or I'm spending a lot of time in, status meetings or something like that. But understanding where that is, where that time is being spent, and learn from it, at least learn from it.
Absolutely. And yeah, especially if you look at Scrum by the book, right? They claim, like, a product owner, there's one product owner per product, right? So I've been a product owner at most for 5 teams, but there were 10 teams working on a single product. And you can't be a product owner for 10 teams if you're involved with every sprint of every team. It's just not going to work.
And that's one of the things where, how much does the team need you? And you had a really good article, and we'll put a link to that, is how much does the team need you to be able to get through their sprint or look ahead to the next one? Again, something that you can see with that division of time that you're spending is, where are you spending the most of your time? I would argue, and this is kind of a rough guide, but if you're spending more than 50% of your time in the current sprint, you probably could reduce that. And because I've seen up where, 80, 90, 100% of the time where that some product owners and teams are spending just in their bubble of the current sprint. They don't know any, the earth could crash into, the sun or something else could happen and they wouldn't know, because all they're focused on is how can we get this work done in the next 2 weeks? But they're not looking at the next sprint. So that's kind of my imperfect measure of how much time should you spend. If you're going over, 50% in the current sprint, then probably need to look at what you're doing.
I think it all depends as well on the maturity of your team, right? I mean, if you're just joining a new team, you need to build relationships, you need to gain trust, you need to meet them where they are, right? You cannot immediately start working in a different way. So it's quite normal in the beginning that you spend more time with the team. But what I can tell you is, so at one company I worked at, I had 3 teams, and it probably was around 20 to 30% of my time that I was spending with the team. The rest was stakeholder management. It was a very political company, a lot of powerful stakeholders, which meant, and also a lot of stakeholders who were in the feature factory mindset. So I need to spend a lot of time talking to them, and also failing, right? I need to convince them to work differently. It's not easy. And yeah, talking to customers. I mean, that's where you should be spending your time, because that's what's going to drive value, not delivering something in the sprint.
Yeah, you're right. The maturity of the team, the maturity of the organization, the maturity of the customers and the stakeholders that you're working with, all that will have an impact on this. I've worked in places where the teams were really good and the stakeholders needed much more time. I spent more time with them than I did with the teams. And I felt okay with that because the teams were really good at focusing on what mattered and working on delivering those increments. I've had the opposite too. I've had some instances where, the stakeholders got it or understood, and the teams, I spent a lot of time with them because they didn't understand why we needed testing or why we needed, CI/CD or something like that. So it just depends on your situation and really where the bigger need is.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And that's what you need to figure out, I think, as a product owner. Like, what's the current situation and where would you like to be and how you're going to get there?
Something else that you mentioned, and it's this the Big A Agile, or the Scrum Police when they come, because they're coming for you.
Boy,
are they coming for you? Is that Scrum is not the thing that matters, and so many people lose track of this or sight of this, where they focus on the things that are inside the sprint, or do we have our stand up, and is that important? Was it 15 minutes, and was that important? But they're only focused on the ceremonies. They're only focused on the. This is where that cargo cult mentality comes in, is they're only focusing on that aspect of it, and they're not looking at what they're delivering. Is our velocity okay? Is our backlog okay? that doesn't matter nearly as much as much as I love Scrum, as much as you love Scrum. That's not the point of all this stuff.
Yeah. So what I can say is, like, perfect Scrum, what does it produce? A product increment that meets the sprint goal. And then it's a step towards this product goal, which they recently came up with. Mm-hmm. So, but whether that sprint goal or product goal are valuable, that depends on how much you understand the customer and also how much you understand whether you can capture that value for the business. And it has nothing to do with Scrum.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's the biggest misunderstanding, like that because Scrum drops this word value constantly in the Scrum guide. It's a framework for delivering value, but they're super prescriptive on delivery. And when it comes to how you deliver value, it's kind of like, yeah, you have the product owner. You will do it. Good luck.
Yep. And one of the folks, and that's where that focus of keeping that bubble intact comes from, which is, you know, they're only focused on, we can't burst this thing that we've so gingerly put together that it could pop at any moment. We can't talk to another team. We can't have any changes.
Correct.
It's so much focused on our actuals and estimates are very important to us. A, I don't think they should be, but B, you're missing the point. If you're focused on getting those 24 story points delivered and doing that every sprint, you've missed the point of all this stuff.
You're absolutely right. I think it boils down to, it's easy to measure, right? Like, oh, we finished 20 story points and next time we did 24. And then we can be like, oh, great job, you know? But
yeah,
in the end, it's kind of like how I compared it is basically... it's kind of like telling a joke, right? Building, like when you tell a joke, what matters is that people laugh. And it's not about how many jokes you tell, right? It's about, does it make people laugh? And it's the same with features. Delivering more features doesn't mean you're delivering value. It's all about how is it perceived and how does it help the customer to meet their goals? And that requires you to really dig in, like dig deeper, like we said before, to really understand. How is this helping our user to meet their goals?
Exactly. One of the things you have in your article, you have some signs that you're locked in a Scrum prison because the Scrum police have come along and they've thrown you in there. So one of the signs that I read and I thought about, and I don't know if I fully understand it or fully agree with it, is you say that product owners frequently respond to somebody who says, can you do this? That the product owner will say, we don't really have time for that. Come back next sprint.
Yeah.
With that same notion of trying to keep that bubble intact, that, you know, we can't change. Part of my, I've done it where I've said exactly that. I've used that exact phrase or something similar to that, which is, you know, this is what we've got planned for the sprint. You're asking to do this, and it's not either the higher priority, it doesn't help us meet our goal, or whatever else. So we're not going to do that. We might do it next sprint. And I've also done it where, you know, something came in last minute, mid sprint, whatever, and it was more important than the things we were working on, or it did make sense to make a change, and then we would do that. So I don't know if I guess it's always context dependent on what it is and what else you're doing or what else you've already done. But how have you seen people react poorly to that notion of we can't make any changes during the sprint, come back later?
Basically, what I was trying to convey is, like, as you said, it depends on the context, right? I mean, but the default answer should not be, we're not helping you because the stress. If that's your default answer, you're doing something wrong, because maybe what they're asking is super valuable. Like, you need to listen. That was the key point. So the thing is, I can give you an example. So this there was something in the sprint. So actually, this was in the sprint, right? So, but the thing is, the SFTP credentials, they weren't added. And basically, they could just have it pointed to a dummy location, continue with the sprint. But they actually removed it before the sprint started because, yeah, we don't have the SFTP credentials. So all the work could happen except just having it point to the right SFTP folder. And this is an example of this mindset, right? Where you're just like, oh, no, like it's not clear. So it goes out of the sprint. And yeah, I also think sometimes you have a production issue, right? Then you're going to help. You're not going to say it all depends on what they're asking. And if it's super small and super valuable and you're going to help someone close a deal or whatever, like it all depends on context. And that flexibility, I believe, is super important. But of course, like you said, not at expense of losing a huge amount of focus, which will come back to haunt you.
Yeah, that notion of we plan for an iteration and that iteration is 2 weeks or that sprint is 2 weeks or whatever. And we're going to try to deliver that that goal. And those, you know, that's what the plan has been done. And if something comes in that interferes with that goal, then, you know, I would have to look at, is this goal still the most important thing? Is it still relevant? Or has something changed? And you're right. I should be able to look at that. If I'm getting 100 of these a day, there's a bigger problem, yes. Right? This is not just about prioritizing one or two requests. It's, okay, there's something else that's going on. Maybe we ought to look at that. But if it's one or two every sprint or something like that, then that's something that I feel like I've been able to handle in the past as a product owner.
And what I also think is important is don't plan your full sprint. Don't plan 100% capacity because whenever the unexpected happens, which we know happens because we're doing complex work, right? We don't know everything up front. We'll figure out something we didn't know. Then you're going to fill the sprint. It's guaranteed. So just give you some wiggle room because that wiggle room can be used for whatever happens.
Yeah. In 10 years, I've never had not enough work.
No.
I've never had a lack of work or lack of things that needed to be done for any team in any industry with any company.
Me neither. I recognize that completely.
Yeah. And something else in your articles about the product owners are great when their team doesn't need them is how can we help? How as we as product owners can help our teams get enough context so they can make some of these decisions as well? It's something you see a lot when people say, well, we got rid of our product owners. How did they do that? Well, they got rid of that role. They still have the skills because people have been taught how important or what the product vision is and what the customers are and what they value, and then what the goals of the product are, and the team can start to internalize and ask some of those questions themselves. And I love it when I see that behavior because then they start debating amongst themselves, not with me, but what, you know, you can start to see those conversations be raised up a level. And I love it when I see that with teams.
Yeah, no, I think, for example, like you said before, product vision, like having a clear product vision is super important. But for example, when you join a new company, often there isn't this product vision.
Right.
It's not something which is going to happen overnight. And I think the most important part of the product vision, which often gets overlooked, is there's two things. It needs to apply focus, right? And because of that, you can say no to things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cannot say no to things, it's not a vision, right? It's just too broad.
Right.
Like anything you do gets you there. And I think that's very important. So to make it concrete, for example, Steve Jobs, right? He actually visited Xerox PARC in exchange for granting them the ability to buy some stock. It was the best deal ever. So he saw the mouse there. It was like 300. So it cost at the time around $300 to build. And it was lying there around for years. And he saw it. He was like, this is something magnificent. And he actually took that mouse. He went to a designer and he said, it needs to do three things. It needs to be $15 to manufacture. It needs to work on Formica and jeans, and it should last for a few years. And that's what he said. And that's a clear vision, right? Like that paints his vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so difficult to do, but this is a perfect example for me. Like if you have that vision, then you know, oh, what kind of decision do we need to make? We're not going to build it out of something which isn't durable, right?
Yeah.
And we're not going to build it with diamonds, right? Because it needs to be cheap.
And that's, I've had teams that got that. And when they started, when you start doing something like that, or when I started with at least a couple of the teams, it was uncomfortable for them. They didn't know exactly what they were doing. And so you have to encourage that, right? You have to encourage that behavior. You have to encourage that curiosity and those questions. And I would take some specific tacks. Like I would ask them questions about what they thought of it just to encourage that. And then once they start doing that, and you come back to them and you see them working or you talk to them about a question that they had or a decision that they made, I want them to talk more about that. I want to get inside their head to understand what they were thinking when they did that. It's not to question and it's not to judge them. It's to say, how deeply do you really understand this? Because if you understand it at a level that I understand it, then great. If you don't understand, if you missed a little thing, then I can help fill that in. So the next time this happens, you're in a much better place. So I like that notion of asking questions and validating kind of that knowledge that they already have on those things like vision, customers, and values.
And as well, they come to you with questions sometimes as well, right? Like, hey,
mm-hmm.
how should we do this? And like you said before, like that's the perfect opportunity to ask them questions. Like it sounds a bit, how do you say, traditional management style, right? But you can just ask them, what do you think?
Yeah.
And why? And then you have this dialogue. And very often, you know, because you're the product owner, right? Like what I try to do is when we work on something, I try to explain, why are we doing this? What are we expecting to achieve? Of course, I sometimes do that imperfectly where I make mistakes. But by knowing what you've discussed, you can actually say, hey, we talked about this. Like, do you remember this? And then they're like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, then we should do this. And then you're like, he got it. Like, just give a little hints. And then the next time, they won't come with this question, like, because they are aware of the context.
Yeah. And the same is true when you have a lot of product data or a lot of information that you can look at. Getting that information to the team and not holding it outside from some outside organization or hiding something. The team should know these types of things. They should know how people are traversing the application, what the raw numbers, or at least what the most important numbers and metrics are that we're tracking. Because they will probably, they probably know a better way to solve this than, you know, either you do or the people that are coming up with some of these ideas. They can look and see, and they can test things out a lot quicker and a lot better than you or somebody else can.
I think you're spot on. And I think you raise a very interesting point, because if you look at the sprint review, what are we often doing? We're discussing what we delivered the last 2 weeks. But at the end of the day, that's not that interesting. How's the product doing? Like, what's retention like? Like, we released that new feature 4 weeks ago. How's it doing? Should we kill it? Should we polish it? These discussions don't happen at the sprint review. Like, and these should be happening, because yes, that's what's going to make a difference. Not what we did this past 2 weeks. Of course, it matters, right? But
yeah,
not as much as figuring out how is it actually being used.
And then something else that I've mentioned before is that notion of looking up and out as a product owner. Again, don't get trapped in the bubble. Don't look at just what you're doing, but look at what's at least in the next sprint, probably what's in the next two sprints, and then, you know, longer term, what are the high level things that we should be looking to hit? So if you want to look at that as a true roadmap or a true problem-based roadmap that you're talking with customers and stakeholders about, that's fine. Look up and out and understand where you're, I mean, it's kind of like driving in a car, right? You want to look out the windshield. You don't just want to look at your gauges all the time. So look out the windshield, look at where you're going and help the team understand that as well, both with, you know, what's coming up in the next sprint, the strategy, does that need to change in 6 months or so? Are the value that we're delivering, does that need to change at some point? And if so, to what?
I think you're right. And yeah, as long as you keep the roadmap, big picture, high level, that's exactly what you should be doing. And then as it comes nearer in the mirror, then you're going to look at the detailing, right? But I think that's the key thing. Like, don't fool ourselves by all these things that which might appear 6 months from now, but already working them out, because they, objects are closer than they, I don't know what they say in the mirror in the US.
Yes. Yes. Very celebrated. So you give some really good strategy, some specific things to do to make sure that you're not stuck in the bubble, that you make sure that you're not really trapped in just looking at this iteration or the sprint. One of the things I really like is, again, focus on that sprint goal. What is the goal of the sprint? Not how many stories or how much velocity or anything else, or did we do with the stand-up? Just what's the goal that we're trying to accomplish this sprint? I think that's a very important one. Another one that you mentioned, don't plan to full capacity, right? Keep a little back. This is the notion where if you're going to use some type of estimation, there's ways that you can do it with like 90% confidence, but really just don't load it. I was talking to a team the other day that they constantly planned 80 points and they only ever did 60. I'm like, why are you planning 80 points every time? You're constantly not getting what you planned done. Not that that's the important thing, but you're lying to yourself. Why are you continuing to do that? Stop. And the other thing that you mentioned that I really like is trusting the team to do more. Again, giving them more responsibility, teaching them how to do more of these product-related thinking type things. Those are three, I think, specific things that you can do if you're a product owner and you're stuck in that bubble. Try those things out.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the key thing when communicating a goal, it's about giving them the intent. Like, what are we trying to achieve and why? And then that means that they can make decisions on how to best reach that goal. So I think one of the challenges when you start the sprint, right, time is fixed. people are fixed. I mean, you could add more people, but it's not going to help most of the time.
Yeah.
And quality is fixed because in Scrum, you have a definition of done, right? We could, of course, say screw quality sometimes, which we should do sometimes because there might be a reason. But generally, we shouldn't be doing that. So then what do you have? Scope, right? And I think the key thing is set a goal, make the scope as simple as possible, and then have small stretch goals to make it better. And then if you easily achieve it, then you can work on the stretch goals. And if you don't achieve it, you have something simple that works. And I think that's very hard to do well, but that's the key thing. Like don't add all the bells and whistles, because that simple thing you're asking for could already be super complicated. It's what you don't know, right? Mm. And what you discover that makes it often two or three times as difficult. So keep it simple. You can always add the bells and whistles later.
Yep. And one of those articles that I was reading of yours had a statement that the product owners should have no active role during the sprint.
Yeah.
Explain that a little bit more to me, because I was confused.
Well, I mean, what I meant is, so I believe if you have a clear goal and they know what they're trying to achieve, then they shouldn't really need you that much, right? I'm not saying completely no role, but I think the more mature you make the team, then, I mean, I think I also believe in trust, right?
Yes.
So if you really have a mature team and they really understand the customer and the business quite well, let them make mistakes. Like that's what I believe. Like if you always need to check everything, then yeah, they're not gonna learn, right? They're not gonna be self-managing team. Like, mm-hmm. And I think that's what I try to do. Like I try to give them responsibility, let them make mistakes, not disastrous mistakes, right? But, and then they can learn from it and then they will need me less. But you cannot, if you're learning to ride a bike or if you're learning anything where you're in your stretch zone, you need to be able to make mistakes, because otherwise you're not really going to be learning so fast.
Hmm. Okay. That's interesting. A lot of the times where the best teams that I've worked with, I was not needed for the sprint, but I was involved with the sprint, and I think they enjoyed that, the teams that I worked with. And there's multiple teams and multiple products with different companies. And I enjoyed the hell out of that, because I like seeing them work together. I like seeing what they did. I like seeing the craft that they produced every day. I like seeing how they did that. And I like seeing them talk about it. So, and I was there and I did answer some questions and I did ask some questions. But in thinking about it, I don't know if I had an active role in the sprint. I had more of a, I mean, I guess I was the definition, which is I was a team member.
Yeah.
I was involved a little bit. I wasn't a bottleneck, and I wasn't maybe I decided, 2% of the things during the sprint, but it was that no active role that I was kind of reacting to.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's maybe a bit too strongly phrased, that I do have to admit. So what I do have to say is, what I also think is very important is this whole team mindset, right? Mm-hmm. We're all in the same boat. You don't want, but I also think, so there's this balance, right? Because if you're doing, I was doing like three and I've also done five teams, then you cannot be involved to this extent. And I do agree with you. It's super fun to be involved, right? I like working with the team.
Oh yeah.
But if you're working with three or five teams, I don't know what your experience is like. Maybe you've found a better way than me. But you cannot be involved in that to that level. Like I've tried it, and I was working way too many hours and not happy.
No, there is definitely a point, and I think I've gotten to the point, again, depending on the maturity of the team, the product, the customers, and everything else, I've found that usually about three is where I start to fall apart a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially if it's different. I mean, I know some product owners are stuck in the situation where they have to do it for multiple products. I've also been in the situation where it's the same product with multiple teams that are focusing on multiple areas. That's easier. It's still not easy. But yeah, once I get to about three different situations of sprint activities or sprint things, that's where my head starts to fall apart. At least I think I do.
No, I think it's the same. I agree with you. Three is doable. It's not the most fun, right? You can do it.
Yeah.
But the moment you go to five, that's when you start becoming a bit insane. And of course, it's not black and white. It depends on the amount of products, how mature the teams are. But so it depends, right? But I don't think there are a lot of product owners that can do that, even though the Scrum people say, yeah, one product owner per product. If you ask all the people that are actually doing the product owner role, they'll say, hell no, that's not how it works.
Yeah, you definitely don't want to be the bottleneck. I mean, there's going to be some bottleneck in your process. You don't want it to be you as the product owner. Okay, and then in conclusion, on a couple of your articles, some of the things you had that I really like, again, something that we've talked about, Scrum is never the point. It shows you what's going on. I like this notion of Scrum always puts the ball in your court to do something about it in a way that best fits your situation. Most people that complain about Scrum are actually whining about the poor decisions their team or organizations made.
That sounds harsh.
I find that sounds harsh because it reflects what I've seen as well over 10 years of people wanting to blame the process or the framework or the methodology or whatever for their, like you said, poor decisions, ill-informed decisions, or just things that they can't accept responsibility for. They want to use it as an excuse and they blame it on something else. I like the notion, I think it was Ron Jeffries who said, Scrum won't fix your problems, but it'll show them to you.
Yeah.
You get to choose what you want to do about it.
Yeah, and the ostrich in the sand method is a very famous method.
Yes, yes. That's what drives me more crazy than anything, is not the fact that you don't know or companies don't know that this is going on. It's that they intentionally don't do anything about it, or they intentionally, you know, say, well, we're not worried about that. That's the part where I go, why are you doing it then? Yeah. If you say... And this is, I'm using air quotes here. If you say that you're agile or you say you use Scrum or something else, maybe you do, maybe you don't. That's not the point. The point is, again, better delivery of customer value and for the benefit of your company and your users. But if you say you're doing these things and we show you a problem, and we say, you know, we could get better by doing this. I've worked in organizations where we got 30% better and we said, that's enough. You know, 30%, we increased quality 30%, we've reduced defects, we've gotten 30% more releases done, whatever it was always 30%. But that was enough for them because they didn't want to do the things that would really enable them to do 30 times more things, which is, you know, in some organizations, it really is possible to do 30 times more than you're doing now if you really wanted to change those things and be one of the best companies. But you don't have to.
No, I think you're right. I think the key challenge is it really requires a paradigm shift. Like, that's the difficult thing. So Scrum on the team level is already quite challenging because basically we're always, when you go to university or you go to school, you're always taught like, hey, here's the book, study it, you can get 100%. That's deeply ingrained. And you can actually see this with all the people who go into business, right? Fresh from academia, they're always thinking, we can analyze everything. And the reality is you can't. And how do you deal with that? That's by being flexible. So discovering what you don't know and reacting based on that information. But that flexibility on the team level is already difficult. But when you have all these teams and departments that need to be flexible toward each other, because that's in essence what needs to happen, that's crazy difficult.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things where you got to recognize that you're in that bubble. You got to do things to get yourself out of it. There's lots of different ways that Martin has in his articles. And you write a lot more on Serious Scrum and a few other places as well. So please go check out some of the things from Martin. Is there any other articles that I didn't mention that kind of relate to this topic, Martin?
Oh, I think you mentioned the most important ones. But if any come to mind, I'll send it over. I've written quite a lot of articles, so I don't always remember everything, unfortunately.
Well, it's out in the world. It's fine. We can go and look at it later. Okay. So, Martin, something I always do for the first-time guests is I ask them three questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here are three questions. Okay. First question is, what are three products that you use in your personal life, and tell me why you love them?
Oh, that's a good question. So, first of all, I really like Medium, because I write a lot on Medium. Okay. And I really like that it's pretty simple. Like, I could get started writing very easily. What I actually like about it, it doesn't get in my way. It doesn't, I actually don't focus on Medium. And of course, it has its stuff which it can do better, but I really like it. I also really like Grammarly, because basically, yeah, you get really great actionable feedback to improve your writing, and it really helps me grow.
Okay.
Let me think of another product which I really like. Ba-ba-ba-ba. I also really like Todoist. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think it's really, really, it's the same thing actually. Like, it's very easy to use. You get these points, which I care about, and I don't know why, because they don't do anything. But I like them. There's this little hoarder in me that wants to have more points.
mm-hmm.
And so these are products I really like. And I think the core thing for me is these products, I actually don't wonder how do they work or what can I do. They just whatever what I want to achieve, I can. And
mm-hmm.
they're like my focus never shifts towards the product, actually. I'm just doing okay. my thing. And that's what I like about these products.
They don't get in the way. I like that. Okay. Second question is, what's the second most amazing thing you've seen a product owner do? Usually people have a favorite story they tell, but what's kind of your second favorite story that you've seen a product owner do?
The second favorite story that I've seen a product owner do? Whew. I have something. The most amazing thing I saw. So this person wasn't really a product owner, right? But he did something which I do consider like in the realm of product ownership. So basically, I was working at a company and they had to rebuild their whole platform,
mm-hmm.
which is not an easy sell, right? Especially because there were like 16 very powerful stakeholders with very strong opinions.
Yeah.
And he managed to convince everyone, hey, we're going to rebuild the platform and you're getting nothing for 9 or how many months.
Wow.
You're actually getting nothing. And the thing is, the way he sold it made total sense, right? I saw the presentation and what he actually did was quite interesting. So basically, one of the biggest factors, it was an e-commerce platform. So one of the biggest factors to rebuild it was speed. So what he actually did is he disabled a lot of scripts and functionality to show how much the impact of improving the speed would be in the bottom line. And he basically said, look at this roadmap, look at all the business cases. I don't remember the numbers, right? I'm just making them up. It's 10 million. If we do this, it's going to be 50 million. Like if we just only do this. And it was based on the hard data, right? Like really, he convinced everyone. And I was really impressed because it's not an easy sell. Like all these people, they have their own things that they want, their own politics. Yep. That was one of the most amazing things. Like he got everybody on the same page because he had amazing salesmanship and influencing skills. And
that's great.
I'm not able to do that. I'm honest, but I saw that and I was just like, I tried to learn from that.
Yeah. No, that's great. I love it when you can tie something into real money, especially if your company is concerned with that. And most companies are. I mean, there are some companies that are more concerned about customer value and customer outcomes and things like that. Unfortunately, most places I've been in, it's been about the cost or the money or something else. So if you could find a way to tie that in and get them interested in it, that's great. That's a great tactic. And then salesmanship on anything, not just sales, but salesmanship is a really good
thing. And he was an American, by the way. So he was really, I mean, that's what I found. I mean, I've not worked with many Americans, but they usually have this salesman. They get it somehow. Maybe it's because you have so many commercials, right? Like compared to us, I don't know, right? But I'm generalizing, of course, a bit.
It could be. Question number 3 is, what product ideas are you most excited about in the future?
What product ideas? And what do you mean by that exactly?
The products that don't exist today, but are being talked about for next year, next 5 years or so. What's the most interesting product idea that you've seen, heard, or are interested in?
Well, I mean, I sometimes have these ideas myself and I'm super excited by them, but I don't know if they mm-hmm. make any business sense. And then sometimes I find out actually there are companies working on this. So let me give you an example, right? And this is just a crazy example. So basically shopping for aftershave or perfume, it sucks. Like in my opinion, you walk into a store and you see all these packaging and you're all focused on this packaging, right? Because mm-hmm. I mean that's what I do, and then the packaging has no bearing on whether it smells nice. But of course the brand affects you, because if it's a nice brand, it smells differently. I'm quite confident that's it affects you psychologically.
Okay.
So what I was thinking is, why isn't there just an app which just lets you smell a couple of scents and then uses machine learning to say, hey, if you like these scents, And then
for people,
but maybe I don't think it will work, right? Because the thing is, at the end of the day, people buy this perfume for this brand and this luxury experience. Like, I'm wearing Ralph Lauren and I'm wearing Coco Chanel. So I don't think it's a great business idea, but it was something I was thinking, boy, this is annoying. Like, I don't care about the brand. I want it to smell nice.
I think what you really want is scratch and sniff phones. I can have my phone and I'm in a store and I scratch a thing and I can smell my phone and get the actual scent.
Yeah, exactly. That would be super nice. It would also be sometimes maybe a bit inconvenient, right? Depending on when it is activated. If you're watching certain movies.
That's the one sense that, so we can do audio, we can do visual, we can even 3D print food. So we can get taste done, but And we can touch, we have haptic stuff, but smell is something that's kind of the unbroken wall that we've not figured out how to do yet.
So maybe if we have a replicator, right? Maybe if we have that, then we can fix the scent problem.
All the problems are solved if we have replicators.
Yeah.
I can get my Earl Grey hot and all the problems are solved. All right. Very good. Thank you, Martin, for answering your three questions. That was great. And for any feedback or questions about product ownership, contact the show on Twitter at DeliverCast or email us at DeliverCast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. The first question is from Silvio, who has a chicken and egg positioning issue with getting feedback. He says, I'm in a very early stage startup with a basic product build. I'd call it over the burnt pizza threshold, which is something we talked about last episode. The problem is, because of how we built it, we've kind of misled the witness. And after getting very early feedback, we realized we need to shift the emphasis of the problem we're solving. Also realized the people that we need to build it for are different from the original group that we talked to. At this stage, engineering is our most expensive thing since we're contracting. So I really want to validate the alternative approach where we put the money into building it. Trying to get completely new people to give you feedback on a prototype actually seems harder than selling something you've built. So how do you get feedback from something that you're just starting to build before you actually get it to build it? Again, this is where the notion, for me, this is where the notion of a MVP, a true MVP, experiments, early prototypes, what are you trying to build? Get that out there and track it with data, track it with feedback. I was just talking to somebody the other day about, they said, well, you know, they've got this idea, they build these five things and they build it over the next, you know, 3 months, then they could completely redo their whole thing. I said, that's great. Why are you waiting 5 months to build or 6 months to build five things? What can you build? You know, what's the most likely one that you could build in 2 days or get something out in 2 days and that 2% of the solution that you could build and see how it works? That's the notion where I think everybody says, well, I have to have a complete solution. My feedback is you have to have something that works. Again, my threshold is usable, not useful. If you look at Goico's kind of pyramid of software needs, let's get to that usable point first. Let's be embarrassed by what we released to a few people to get some feedback to say, how can we improve this? So I would, even if it's a different market, a different product, a different problem, those are still things that I would do regardless of what I was working on.
I think you're spot on. Like, I think you first need to do something that doesn't scale before you worry about scaling it. I think that's what Reid Hoffman talks about in his podcast. So I can give you an example from, Zappos, the Delivering Happiness book. So, I mean, if my memory serves me right, because I read it a few years back. So basically how it started out is it was a website where you could, basically, Zappos is an online shoe e-commerce company, right? So just to be clear, for people that don't know, they're very famous in the US. Outside the US, not everybody knows them. So basically, you could download an Excel sheet from a WordPress website. You could say which shoes you wanted. Email it. Somebody would look at this Excel sheet and walk to the store, to a retail store, buy these shoes and ship them to you. That's how they started. And the fact that that experience was pretty terrible, right? But there were people who were willing to go through that because it was like they were actually, it was solving a problem for them. Like, it was very convenient. And that if you have something which is that suboptimal, but still people are using it and liking it, then you know there's something there and you can build upon that. And that's when you know you really have a problem worth solving. Like, if the market accepts this suboptimal solution, because like, hey, this is making my life better. Even if it's not perfect, I'm going to use it.
Yeah, one of the best things that I've seen personally that I've been involved with. I'm sure I've told this story before. There was an MVP that a product person did with their customer support team that involved building zero software because they couldn't get a team for another 9 months to build anything. They had this initiative. They had this thing they needed to do. They weren't going to be able to build it for 9 months. But what we were able to do is validate the need by running a 6-week experiment. And that experiment involved, you know, we had to get legal involved. We had to get the customer support team involved. And we tried it and we got good data. The numbers were better than they expected. And the sad thing was that didn't change anything. So, but it validated the need. The interesting thing would have been, what if it didn't validate the need? Would you have still done it or not? My gut says they probably would have because they'd already done the budget, which is sad. But at least you go into that going, look, we're going to spend, you know, honestly, $5 million in building something that nobody's going to recognize any value on.
Ouch.
And I would keep saying that, which is sad. But so there you go, Silvio. Hope that helps some when you're looking at that. Another question was from Yared. Had a suggestion for a PM in business intelligence. It says, hi, I'm relatively new PM over my mid-sized 450-person startup business intelligence team looking for some advice. Our team builds dashboards for and distributes data insights into a good chunk of the company staff. We have 11 analysts, BI analysts, working on these dashboards and analytics. There are so many requests and projects at a time that I'm constantly context switching and feel like I only do a mini project management method for discovering user needs for each project. I've organized stakeholders into 5 zones relative to company OKRs, starting working with stakeholders in each zone to uncover needs and priorities, and have analysts working on projects for each zone. What could we be doing differently to improve flow and reduce top-down product management? I've worked with some BI or some data science type teams before, organizations or whatever. One of the interesting thing is, you know, you're usually all using the same tool. So your product offering is probably about the same thing. And I've become really sensitive to the word dashboards because everything's a dashboard nowadays. Or if we could just get a dashboard, then we could solve this problem. I don't think they know what the dashboard is going to do for them. They just want to see the data in something. So part of what I would do and what I have recommended people do is, what problem does your dashboard solve? They want to see the data in the dashboard. Again, why? What are they going to do with that data? What are they going to do with that notion or dashboard? Because odds are they're going to do something else with that data that your dashboard is irrelevant for. I've worked with several people that we built them a dashboard and the dashboard was useless because they just wanted to export the data. And the dashboard was the easiest way for them to do that because they didn't have to go through SQL injection or SQL statements or any other kind of exports. It was just easier through Tableau or something else. So understanding what value your dashboard provides is a very important thing. And then you can actually, I like the notion of putting them into zones. These are 5 different personas or 5 different people who are going to be using the type of data we produce. Understanding their needs, I think, is great. Understanding them in relation to each other. You have 11 analysts, so you probably got enough where you could focus on one, you know, again, look at your data. Of those 5, which one's asking for the most things? And what are they asking about? Is there a way you can kind of group that together, kind of plan on that? That's how I would approach the project aspect of it or the planning aspect of it. Is look at where those things are coming in, see if there's some similarities with you can build and solve some of those problems by building less, and then see how you go from that. You know, try that for a month, see what happens, you know, make some tweaks to it and see how you go on. But that's about the only thing I could think of just from the email.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. So the way I read it differently, right? Like, so what I thought that, so I mean, I think your solution is perfect. That's not what I'm saying. But the way what I've seen very often happen with business intelligence teams is that other teams depend on them, mm-hmm. right? So they're always the bottleneck because every team is doing stuff where they need data, where they need insights. So I think it's super important to develop these tools so teams don't need you for these for a lot of these basic things. Spend some time on that. Because otherwise, they're always going to be coming to you at some point late in their project, right? When they realize they need something, because people always miss stuff or they realize something too late. It doesn't fit in the planning you made.
Yep.
And yeah, that flexibility you cannot give them, I think, unless you teach them how to fish, right? So I think that's also a solution. Like, are there simple things where you can actually give them a little bit more control to do things on their own without, of course, sacrificing quality? But yeah, that could also be a solution.
Yeah. And because of the product that you work on in your day job, Martin, is there anything related to the project management aspect of this that you've seen either users of your product do or other project?
No, unfortunately not. So it's mostly, our product is mostly for smaller creative agencies. So they're not with like 450 people with all these different stakeholders. So unfortunately, and I've not seen this. Otherwise, of course, I would say, hey, I know someone, contact me.
Yeah. Well, and so it sounds like they're doing actual project work and not just, they're not doing product work in project form.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. All right. Hopefully that helps Silvio and Jared. And if you have questions, again, feel free to ask. And a big thank you to Martin Dalmer. Martin can be found on Twitter at MDALMIJN and also at your website and Serious Scrum. We'll have links to those in the show notes. Anything else you want to let folks know is going on, Martin?
I'm busy writing a book on sprint goals. So with Addison Wesley for In the Mycone series. And yeah.
Very good.
Feel free to send me a message on LinkedIn if you found it interesting or you have any questions.
Very good. All right. And don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaiju.com. All opinions expressed here are mine. Find more of them at Ace Corey Brown on Twitter. That is episode 127 delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.